Chapter 5. Darkness concealed our return to the Mayflower's upper deck. However, the sun was close to rising and would soon stretch its rays across the eastern horizon. A light breeze drifted across our faces, reminding us that winter was just around the corner. We appeared to have landed on the ship we left from, except instead of September, it was now November. It was still too dark to see much, but I was worried about the condition of the passengers and crew. I knew they lacked food and water. I knew they lacked good nutrition, particularly vitamin C in their diet. Certainly, this would cause many to suffer from scurvy, a disease known to cause swollen and bleeding gums and ultimately death. And most important, I knew they lacked hope. For days and weeks, the pilgrims hoped that they would find land. They hoped for an end to the miserable conditions they had to endure. Now, after suffering for 2 months, there was still no sign of dry ground. Even I could feel the grip of hopelessness trying to strangle me. I quickly turned to Liberty and Tommy in an effort to break the despair I was feeling. "Nice jumping, Liberty," I said, scratching him behind the ear. "Ah, shucks, I bet you say that to all the magical horses that leap you across the Atlantic Ocean," Liberty said, grinning. Tommy jumped off Liberty's saddle and said, "Hey, if there are other horses like you, I want one." Curious, I asked, "If you had a horse like Liberty, what exceptional event in American history would you visit first?" Tommy thought, "that's a tough one. Probably 1969, when the Apollo 11 launched into space and Neil Armstrong became the first man to set foot on the moon. That would be awesome." "Oh, I remember watching that on television," said Liberty. "When he landed on the moon, he said, 'That's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.' Although, personally, I think a giant leap through time is more impressive." "Wait, you mean that if you wanted to, you could time jump to the moon?" Tommy asked. "Well, if a cow can jump over the moon, certainly a horse can," Liberty huffed. "All right, kids," I intervened. "Let's get back to business. It's almost light enough now to see what's happening on the ship. In fact, I think that's Captain Jones and William Bradford up on the poop deck." Tommy burst out laughing and asked, "Did you just say poop deck?" And then Liberty started laughing. "It's funny when you say it like that, poop deck, poop deck." I rolled my eyes and I waited till the two of them stopped laughing. "Are you finished? Honestly, you're acting like a couple of five-year-olds."
Actually, Liberty said, "I am 5.
And then they both started laughing again. In fact, watching them laugh made me start to laugh. "For the record," I said, smiling, "the poop deck is the deck above the captain's cabin, built in the rear or stern of the ship. I believe the name originates from the French word for stern, la poupée." More laughter. Tommy and Liberty were leaning on each other now, laughing hysterically and saying in their best French accent, "La poupée! La poupée!" "Liberty," I said, "I think you better disappear and hide yourself in the capstan room. I think someone's approaching." Instantly, Liberty vanished as we heard a familiar voice say, "I'm glad to see someone can laugh under the circumstances. Who goes there? Why all the frivolity?" As the voice got closer, we saw Miles Standish, his sword still hanging from his side. His clothes were haggard. He smelled like he hadn't bathed in days or weeks or even a couple months. However, despite his appearance, he was smiling. "Hi, Captain Standish," said Tommy, standing up straight. "Oh, hello, Tommy. Hello, Rush. I was thinking about you just the other day. I meant to come find you, but with all my duties, I'm afraid I've not been very attentive. But I must say, it's good to see you in such fine spirits. Hearing you laugh put a smile on my face. I can't remember the last time I smiled." "Thank you for that," said Miles. "It appears our laughter may be contagious," I said. "Let's hope it spreads quickly. Our people are beginning to doubt. Elder Brewster is encouraging as many as he can. He reminds us to pray day and night, but so many are sick. We're nearly out of water. We have little food. We've had much contention and despair among the passengers and crew. Thankfully, the cruelest of them is no longer with us." "Did someone die?" asked Tommy. "Yes, lad. We've kept it quiet because we didn't want to worry the rest of you below deck. Many days ago, one of the sailors, a vile, profane, and arrogant man, was stricken with disease and died in a wretched way. A thought occurred to me, and I asked, I remember one sailor with a scar above his cheek. He was heartless about our seasickness, threatened to feed all the Puritans to the shark. Was it him? Miles nodded. The very one, he said. That sailor mocked our suffering and cursed our people endlessly. He swore he hoped to cast half of us overboard before we came to our journey's end. Yet he himself was the first to be thrown overboard. The word is spread that it was the just hand of God who did it. Tommy raised his hand as if he were in the classroom and asked, Captain Standish, what happens when people get sick on the Mayflower? Is there a doctor's office on the boat? No, Tommy, not really, said Miles. We have people who care for the sick, but there isn't much that can be done when the illness is severe. You ever feel like you want to give up and go back to Holland? Asked Tommy. No, son, Miles said firmly. Abandoning this voyage is out of the question, at least for me. We must go on despite the hardships. If we give up now, we will never know what land is ahead. If we turn this vessel around, we'll be back to a place where we cannot really be free. Do you think the king would put all of you in jail? Perhaps, said Miles, even if we made it back to Holland without anyone knowing. We couldn't go to our own church. The Church of England would tell us how we must act and how we must think. Tommy's brow was furrowed as he thought about what Miles had said. Yeah, I don't like when people try to control me. My mom always tells me to think for myself and not just follow the crowd. She says I should stand up for what I believe, even if it's not popular. It sounds like you have a very smart mother, said Miles. Yeah. And she's really strict about me doing my chores around the house. You'd probably really like her. Miles laughed and said, You're an incredibly bright boy, Tommy. I'm glad you're here. You fit in perfectly with our mission. Come, Rush Revere and Tommy, he said. Let me take you to Captain Jones and William. He's navigating the ship from the poop deck. I gave Tommy the look. Both of Tommy's hands went into the air. Hey, the joke's over for me. That was so 1620, he said, winking. As we walked to visit with Captain Jones and William, Tommy said, Captain Standish, I never really got a chance to thank you for, you know, the way you caught me. I mean, you were lightning fast, and then how you lifted me up by my leg. You were like the Hulk. Anyway, thanks for saving my life. Miles stopped, looked at Tommy. Finally said, Tommy, I don't know if I'm any stronger or faster than any other man, but if I've learned anything while living among the Puritans, it's that everything happens for a reason. Simply, you weren't supposed to fall off this ship. It wasn't your time. Boy, is that the truth, I thought. Miles continued, I'm glad I was standing next to you when you fell overboard. I'm glad I could save you. But my part in helping you is over, and yours has just begun. Think of it as a second chance. What will you do with your life now that you couldn't have done if I hadn't caught you? Wow, that's deep. But I get it, said Tommy. Good, said Miles. Go do something great with your life, Tommy. Now, we'll talk more soon. And your first sword lesson begins when we get to dry ground. A man is always better off when he knows how to protect himself and his family. Miles turned to leave, but then stopped with a quizzical look. He asked, Did you say I was like the Hulk? Who or what is the Hulk? Tommy paused for just a second and replied, Oh, well, he's just this guy back home, sort of a hero. He's really strong, pretty much invincible. Thank you for the compliment. I think I'd like to meet this Hulk someday, Miles said, smiling. He then turned on his heel and headed for the ladder. When Captain Jones and William Bradford saw us, William said, Rush Revere! Please forgive my neglect. It's good to see you. I assume you've been surviving with the others below deck. I know I shouldn't assume, but with so many passengers suffering from seasickness, including my wife, I found myself unable to visit everybody I'd like. No worries, I said. Tommy and I are definitely surviving and feeling very optimistic today. I noticed Captain Jones held a 3-foot-long stick on which was attached a sliding cross piece. I assumed it was sort of a compass. That's when Tommy asked, What's that in your hand? It's a cross staff, said Captain Jones. It helps me know where to steer the ship. I place it up to my eye. I measure the distance between a star, the moon, or the sun, and then the horizon. It helps me calculate the ship's position. But with all the bad weather, it's been difficult to know for sure how far we are from land. Curious, I asked, and where are we supposed to be by now? Well, by now I expected us to be at the Jamestown settlement on the Hudson River. At that point in history, the Jamestown settlement extended all the way up the mid-Atlantic coast to what is now New York. But with all the storms, it looks like we've traveled much farther north than I expected, said the captain. Tommy whispered to me,
"That's too bad they didn't have a GPS."
And then William added, "By Captain Jones' calculations, we should spot land in a day or so." "Look," Tommy said, pointing up into the morning sky. "Isn't that a seagull? And there's another. I'm pretty sure those seagulls are coastal birds." In the moment Tommy finished speaking, we heard a sailor shout from above, "Land ho!" Passengers started streaming out from the hatches that led to the tween deck. Many were lifted and helped up the ladder, too sick or weary to walk on their own. Their expressions were mixed between hope and doubt, as if they couldn't believe their ears. The bow of the ship pointed westward as all eyes raced to see what they hadn't seen for more than 2 months. Land! Sure enough, a distant strip of land could be seen on the horizon. As soon as the pilgrims on the upper deck saw the outline of dry ground, they fell to their knees and began to weep. Others shouted for joy, and almost everyone found someone to hug. Elder Brewster called the saints together, and even some of the strangers came, and together they offered a word of prayer. They knelt to give thanks to God for preserving and protecting them. After they prayed, they sang a hymn. Some were too emotional to sing as they watched the approaching land and simply cried tears of relief. Even the sick and weary looked to have renewed health and strength. I noticed William had a giant smile on his face and what looked to be a tear in his eye. He said, "We left Plymouth, England on September 6th, and today is November 9th, Tommy finished. "You've been sailing straight for 65 days. "Very good, Tommy," said Captain Jones. "And many of the passengers have been seasick for all 65 days. William breathed deeply and nearly laughed when he said, "Well, they're not sick now. They're exceedingly happy and grateful that God has preserved us over this vast and furious ocean." "And it looks like a beautiful day," I said. "Soon we'll be on dry ground." "Yes," the captain agreed, "but remember, we are far north of our original destination. We were supposed to land at the Hudson River. Instead, it appears we are headed toward New England, Cape Cod to be exact." "It is needful that we find our way to the coast as fast as possible," said William. "Our provisions are low, and many passengers are sick and even diseased." "We sail by the wind," said Captain Jones, "and right now the wind is coming from the north. We'll sail to the coast and follow the coastline swiftly to the Hudson River." They all agreed, and soon a colony of seagulls flew overhead, welcoming the Mayflower as it drifted out of deep blue waters and into emerald green. Passengers crowded the starboard side of the ship and watched with keen interest at the thick forest of trees and bushes with orange and yellow leaves that grew beyond the empty beaches. I watched these remarkable passengers, amazed at how genuinely tough they were. The kind of hardship they experienced on the Mayflower is something that modern-day people will seldom, if ever, experience. And yet these pilgrims did it with gusto. They hadn't been spoiled by wall-to-wall carpets, central heating, microwave ovens. They lived and endured hard things because that's just how it was. And so they passed the first test. The next would be the building of a new colony. I knew it wouldn't be easy, but I was sure that these rugged individuals would again find a way to overcome any trial. Miles Standish walked up to us and asked, "What catches your eye out there, Tommy?" Tommy gripped the railing as he stared at the passing wilderness. "Oh, well, I was just wondering what might be in those woods," he said, sounding a little bit nervous. Miles answered, "All the things that will sustain us, wood, berries, animals, water, and soil." "And Indians?" Tommy asked. "Yes, probably Indians," Miles said, We will do what we must to protect ourselves. We have swords and muskets and cannons if need be. That's good to know, Tommy said. Hopefully we won't have to use them, said William. As I looked ahead along the coast, I wondered if Captain Jones had ever sailed these waters. Surely every coastline's different, and there's always a chance of hidden dangers. And suddenly a sailor yelled from above, "Shoals ahead! Turn port side!" "Aren't shoals like a sandbank or a sandbar out in the open water?" Tommy asked. "Yes," I said to Tommy softly, "and if I'm not mistaken, this place is called Pollock Rip. It's a ship's graveyard. If the captain doesn't avoid the shoals, the Mayflower could get pinned or even shipwrecked. A direct hit could smash the ship's hull." Waves crashed against the shoals as water swirled up and over the threatening sandbars. The wind died down to almost nothing, but the Mayflower drifted dangerously closer to the roaring breakers. "We are in great danger," said Captain Jones with urgency. His eyes were fixed on the shoals ahead. "A southern wind would be especially helpful right now." Calmly, William said, "We've not come this far to shipwreck now. What must we do?" "Watch for shoals," said Captain Jones, "and keep your people away from my sailors so they can do their jobs." "With God, all things are possible," said Elder Brewster from behind me. I turned and asked, "Do you have any counsel, any advice?" "Pray," he said, smiling. "God will make up the difference. He created the heavens and the earth. Surely he can steer a ship to safety." And remarkably, the wind began to blow, a southern wind. The sails shifted, and the Mayflower turned just in time, missing the shoals by only a few feet. "I'm afraid we won't be landing at the Hudson River. This coastline is too dangerous," said Captain Jones. "Now that the wind has changed directions, our best chance is to sail north, back around Cape Cod to New England." William gave a worried look at Miles, who said, "The strangers will not like it." William looked deep in thought and said, "Yes, the strangers will insist we land at the Hudson." "Well, then they can jump off my ship and swim if they want to," said Captain Jones. "I'll go and explain to them the situation. I will not have a mutiny on my ship." "Captain Standish and I'll go with you," said William. "Russian Tommy, you're welcome to come, but please do not feel like you have to." I eagerly replied, "We are right behind you. If there is anything you need, just ask." "Thank you, Rush Revere, for all the support that you've given." We climbed down from the poop deck to the quarter deck and then climbed down again to the upper deck. Several passengers climbed up from the tween deck. Liberty was waiting for us on the upper deck. As Miles predicted, the strangers were in an uproar when they heard the news. Shouts could be heard from above and below deck. Sounded like a mob. Children were crying, and even the giant mastiff was barking at everyone and everything. "Please," pleaded William, trying to calm both stranger and saint. "I'm sure we can work this out. We've shared the same boat for 65 days. We've had our differences, but we've come to know each other. We've both suffered and survived together. We've shared our provisions and our stories and our dreams, knowing that we, all of us, would be a new colony." Captain Jones added, "I've seen firsthand how saint and stranger have worked together for the good of all. When we were mid-ocean and that monstrous wave cracked one of the ship's core beams, I witnessed how you rallied to find a solution. In desperation, you collectively used a screwjack to help my carpenter repair the fractured beam." One of the strangers stepped forward and raised his hands to speak. "Who's that?" Tommy said. "Is he a stranger or a saint?" Miles leaned over to us and whispered, "That's Stephen Hopkins, a stranger. His wife gave birth to a baby boy during our voyage. They named him Oceanus." Tommy raised his eyebrows and whispered back, "Oceanus?" Miles shrugged his shoulders and smirked. "It's an odd name, for sure," I said, "but when the other kids ask him about it, he can always say, it's because I was born aboard the Mayflower." "Yeah," Tommy agreed. "Not many people can say that." Stephen Hopkins spoke boldly. "We agreed to help and use the screwjack because we all had a common goal, and we all agreed to settle at the Hudson River. And now we're headed in the opposite direction." He pointed at William Bradford, Miles Standish, Elder Brewster, and the other Puritan members and shouted, "Land where you want. But when we come ashore, we'll use our own liberty, for none have the power to command us." "Did he just say they're going to use their own horse named Liberty?" whispered Liberty. "What are the odds there are two horses with the same name on the same ship?" They weren't referring to a different horse. They said, Liberty interrupted, well, if they think that they're going to use me, they better think again. I'm not another man's property. I mean, I used to be, but that was in the 18th century. And just because we're in the 17th century doesn't mean I'm going to give up my 21st century freedoms. Liberty's mouth was so close to my face that his whiskers tickled my ear. I whispered back, nobody is going to use you. They might as well try to tame 1,000 wild horses with nothing but a whistle. Shh, Liberty hushed. I'm trying to listen to what's happening. I resisted the urge to strangle my horse and continued listening. William said, I understand your frustration. I do. We all have advantages by settling at the Hudson River. However, right now, that is not an option. The truth is, the only way for this new colony to succeed financially is if we all stay together and work together. Stephen Hopkins turned to discuss the matter with his fellow strangers. Before long, they reluctantly agreed that a union with the Saints or the Puritans was important for the colony to survive and thrive. William turned to Captain Jones and said, Captain, I request that we set anchor at Cape Cod so that we might compose an agreement, something that would bind us all together. He turned to the large crowd of passengers on the upper deck and continued, We need a document that'll help create just and equal laws in our new colony. And we'll need a government and a governor. But more important, we must choose this by common consent where majority rules. And once this agreement is composed, I propose that we sign it as a promise to obey and support the rules and laws which we agree to. I whispered to Tommy, this is a key moment of American history. The agreement that William Bradford is proposing is the Mayflower Compact. It is said to be just as important to American history as the Declaration of Independence. The passengers agreed to creating the agreement. Captain Jones offered William Bradford his personal cabin and desk to compose the agreement. I approached William and said, That was a difficult situation, but you handled it well. Thank you, said William. It was the mutinous speeches that made me determined to find a solution. And what are you thinking this agreement will do? I asked. It's a good question. By signing this agreement, everyone on this ship is agreeing when we land to live and work together so that we can survive. It'll be a brief outline of self-government. We'll still profess our allegiance to King James, but we also need just and equal laws suited to our new settlement and new way of life. We are far from England. So we must do what is convenient for the general good of the colony. That is really ingenious, I said. If we can get everyone to agree, it will be, William said with a chuckle. I patted him on the back and said, I predict that this very agreement you're proposing will be referred to by many English colonists who will settle in America in the years to come. In fact, it might very well be the beginning of a greater constitution for all Americans. You are always thinking of the future, Rush Revere, said William, smiling. I like that about you. Now, if you'll excuse me, I have some writing to do. William and several other passengers climbed the stairs to the captain's cabin. I love happy endings, whispered Liberty. Ending, I said. Liberty, this is just the start. In a way, this is like Neil Armstrong landing on the moon. It is, Tommy questioned. Absolutely. The Pilgrims may not be the first to discover the New World, but their footprint in New England will eventually lead to the making of the United States of America. Wow, Tommy said. I never thought of it like that. It's hard for me to think about anything with an empty stomach, said Liberty. I grabbed a few more apples out of Liberty's saddlebag and fed them to him. Tommy and I ate an apple as well. When we finished, Tommy asked, Hey, do you think we could climb up and watch them sign the Mayflower Compact? You took the words right out of my mouth, I said. Don't worry about me, Liberty sighed, obviously trying to make us feel guilty for leaving him. I mean, you're off to watch one of the most important events in American history while the rest of us get stuck out in the cold. Reminds me of that one Christmas rain... Rudolph, Tommy said. Yes, Rudolph, the red-nosed reindeer. He wanted to join in the reindeer games, but the other reindeer wouldn't let him. How thoughtless of me, I said. You know, you're absolutely right. We should be filming this so I can use it as a teaching moment back in class. Well, that's not exactly what I, Liberty tried to say, and I added, and I'll find you the biggest, juiciest carrots when we get home. Deal? I asked. All right, Liberty sighed. I suppose nothing says I love you, and I forgive you, and I'll make sure I include you the next time like a big, juicy carrot, or a fresh head of cabbage, or large, crisp turnips. And I'm especially fond of cauliflower. While Liberty continued daydreaming, I whispered to Tommy, let's go. When we reached the quarterdeck to the captain's cabin, we turned to wave at Liberty, who looked deep in thought. We shuffled into the crowded room as many saints and strangers surrounded the captain's desk, where William Bradford was sitting and composing the agreement. Most men were standing, but Miles Standish sat close by William. Miles wore his breastplate and helmet and looked as if he was ready to pounce upon anyone who objected to William's composition. Overall, the room had a peaceful mood. Finally, William dipped the quill into the inkwell and signed his name at the bottom. He dipped the quill again and handed it to Miles Standish, who signed his name. One by one, the men in the room began signing their names. As men exited the cabin, other men entered to sign their names. As the signing continued, Tommy whispered, try taking my picture with your smartphone. I'll squeeze my way in so you can get me by the Mayflower Compact, okay?
I'll do my best, I said.
Tommy squirmed his way to the table and then stood on his tiptoes, smiling a big, cheesy grin. I stood at the back of the room, removed my phone from my pocket, and as discreetly as possible took a picture of Tommy's first event in American history. When Tommy made it back to me, he said, we should go and get Freedom. I feel bad she hasn't been here to see all of this. I don't want her to miss the Pilgrim's Landing. Good idea, I said. We'll slip away before anyone notices. We exited the captain's cabin and climbed down the ladder to the upper deck. But when we looked inside the capstan room for Liberty, he wasn't there. That's odd, I thought. Wait, there he is, Tommy said, pointing to the far side of the ship. And for an instant, Liberty appeared and then disappeared. What was he doing, I wondered. We quickly walked over to where we had last seen him and whispered, Liberty, Liberty, what are you doing? Liberty reappeared right next to us. Pointing at the hatch that led to the tween deck, he said, something fishy is going on down there, and I'm not talking about fish. I watched two teenage boys who looked very mischievous climb down this ladder and say something about shooting off a musket. I've got a bad feeling about this. I'll go check it out, said Tommy. I'll let you know what I see. I paused to think about whether or not that was such a good idea. Finally, I said, all right. But just take a look and then come right back up and tell us what you see. Quick as a cat, Tommy sprang down the ladder. After a couple of minutes, his head popped up and he said, it's the Billington boys. You know those teenagers that Miles scolded for scaring those little kids with the shark story? They're playing with their dad's musket, and I think they're going to try and shoot it. That does not sound good, I said. Yeah, and it gets worse. I noticed they're sitting near a barrel of gunpowder. If the gun ignites the gunpowder, Tommy said, assuming that we knew how his sentence would end. Kaboom, said Liberty. Neil Armstrong won't be the first man on the moon. The Billington boys will be. Tommy, run and get Miles, I said. I'll climb down and try to stop him. Before either Tommy or I moved, we heard a loud musket blast from the deck below. Immediately, Liberty took a deep breath and disappeared. We waited two more seconds and were relieved when the rest of the ship did not blow up. Instantly, the captain's door swung open, and several men streamed out of the cabin, including Captain Jones. Who fired that musket? The captain yelled. Tommy and I pointed to the hatch that led to the tween deck. I whispered to Tommy and Liberty, this would be a good time to time jump. Let's head away from the commotion. As men and women crowded around the hatch and down to the tween deck, we mounted the now visible Liberty, and I said back to modern day. The last thing I heard before we jumped through the time portal was the captain yelling, Francis Billington, if I ever see you with a musket on my ship again, I will strap you to the topmast and let the crows peck out your eyes.